According to Luke's account, in explaining the parable of the sower, Jesus said, "Those by the wayside are the ones who hear. Then the devil comes and takes away the word out of their hearts." We've been engaged in a brief series of lessons that could well have been entitled, "Then the Devil Comes." We began it with a study of the baptism of Jesus and the fact that he was immediately taken up into the mountains to be tempted by Satan, to be tested. This is the lot of every individual. Once we begin to develop faith in God, the devil comes, and he begins to tempt us. And the Lord allows him to do that because the testing of our faith can be a source of strength to us. It can be a blessing to us, first to know whether our faith is real or not, and then really to strengthen and increase the faith that we possess. We've observed that Satan has a number of avenues through which to tempt us, to test us. And he has used various agents through the ages to test the saints of God. We noted last week from the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation that he has used both persecution and false teaching to lead individuals away from God. But this Revelation letter also describes a harlot, a woman that is full of sin, one who is a great temptation to the people of God and carries away many who have turned to the Lord in faith. And I believe this represents the world of seduction to immorality and to sin. And if there are those who are led away by persecution, and if there are those whose faith is destroyed by false teaching, we also have many who are tempted to immorality and who leave the Lord because they are thus tempted. In the book of Matthew, the 15th chapter, Jesus speaks of some of those things that can very well tempt the saints of God and cause them to be left without knowledge of the truth. Looks like we've blown a bulb here. We'll just have to do something else. That's all right. Beginning with verse 19, Jesus says, "Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man." Let's look at these things briefly. He says one of them is murder. Then he speaks of adultery and fornication. And in addition to that, he speaks about false thefts and false witness. And then he speaks of blasphemy. Now, these are all things that the devil would very much like to see us involved in. And when individuals commit murder, when they commit adultery and fornication and theft and false witness and blasphemy, they are obviously denying the faith. They've been called out of the world to be pure, to be holy, to be God's saints. And when they begin to practice these things disqualify them as saints of God. I'm sure that most of us would be inclined to say, "Well, but I'm never going to do those things. You don't think, surely, that after I've become a Christian, that I'm going to commit murder or adultery or fornication or any of these things that are listed here?" Well, if you did, you wouldn't be the only Christian that ever did a thing like that. In fact, you wouldn't be the only child of God that ever did such a thing. If you go back through the Old Testament and consider some of the greatest servants of God that you find there, some of them were guilty of some of these things. You remember that Noah was guilty of drunkenness and brought great shame upon his family and a curse upon the generations that followed because of the things that happened as a result of his drunkenness. Abraham told a lie, not once but twice, very significant lie. You remember that Moses failed to recognize God and allowed his anger, his wrath, to cause him to disobey God and thus lose the opportunity of going to the promised land. You remember that David committed adultery, not only adultery, but murder. He was guilty of several of these things all at one time. And you come to the New Testament, and you have even Peter, whose conduct in the at the trial of Jesus could well be described as blasphemy. Any person who thinks that he is so strong that he's not going to commit one of these sins is one of the persons to whom the Apostle Paul must have been addressing the words, "Let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Don't overestimate your power, the strength of your faith, to think that you can be careless about temptation, to think that this could never happen to you. Some terrible things can happen to anybody if they once relax their vigil, if they once cease to hold on to the Lord. We just don't know really what we would do. But I think that Satan is smart enough to know that he's not going to come up to a person whose heart is good and just say, "I want you to go out and commit murder today." Just beautifully, he'll just pick up a pistol and go out and shoot somebody. That, of course, doesn't happen. Or a person whose heart has been pure and good for a long period of time, and he says suddenly, "Go out and commit adultery today. Take that man's wife. Or go find that girl and take advantage of her. Or just start to go to court and lie to try to cause problems to your neighbor." Nobody's going to just do that on the spur of the moment. Satan knows that in order to bring us to these things that we generally consider extreme sins, serious sins, big sins, he has to condition us. And he certainly has ways of doing that. I didn't really put here on the board everything Jesus mentioned. In fact, if you look again at verse 19 of Matthew 15, you see that it begins with something else. Jesus said, "Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts." Now, those evil thoughts are the things that condition us for these sins that we later may commit. And if we're careless about our thinking, then the next thing we know, we're going to do some things that we just never dreamed we could possibly do. If you look back with me to the fifth chapter of the book of Matthew, you'll see here Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount warning about some of these things. You remember that he said, "You had been told that you shall not murder or shall not kill." It's verse 21. "And whoever murders or kills will be in danger of the judgment." Now, he's talking about the same thing here that Satan would like to have you do, murder somebody. But Jesus said, "I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." Now, what he's saying is there that when you don't control your anger, your thoughts, and then if you let those thoughts begin to be translated into words that are harsh and bitter, speaking with despite for other people, the next thing you know, you may commit murder. Cherry loaned me a book that she had been reading on, a novel, about a murder that took place in one of the large churches in England. And on the succeeding Sunday, the preacher was intending to bring to the congregation the fact that some of them might be very much nearer to the kind of thing that had happened than they realized. And the point he made was this, that the moment you come to feel that your own welfare or your own happiness or your own pleasure is more important than somebody, than everybody else's, then you're on your way to murder. And I believe that's exactly right. I believe that individuals who commit murder somehow or other have reached the conclusion that their own welfare, their own happiness, their own well-being is more important than anybody else. And if in order to pursue my own purpose, my own desire, to pursue my own happiness, as has been suggested, then I'll, if it's necessary to kill somebody, I'll kill him. I'll get rid of him. It's a basic selfishness, and that evil thought is at the root of every kind of sin that is committed in our world today, that I am number one. And the sad thing is that the philosophy of our generation is encouraging this idea that I'm number one and I have a right to be happy no matter what it may do to somebody else, even my own family, my own children. It makes no difference. I have a right to be happy. And so people commit murder. In the book of 1 John, the third chapter, John speaks about this matter of hatred of a brother as being the same thing, actually, as murder. In 1 John 3 and verse 15, he says that if a person hates his brother, he has already committed murder in his heart. In fact, he says he is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Your attitude of heart is the same as the attitude of heart of a murderer, whether you ever get around to actually wiping him out or not. This is something for us to think about. When you begin to think ill of your brother or anybody you know, any human being, and you begin to hate him and you begin to wish that evil things will come on him, you begin to think that I would enjoy seeing him hurt. I'd like to have him out of the way. If you continue to feed that, there's absolutely no telling where it's going to end up. But I want to notice another thing. And that is that adultery is fed, just as murder is by anger, adultery is fed by lust. Look back at what Jesus said again in Matthew the 5th chapter. After speaking about this matter of bitterness leading to murder, he says in verse 27, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now, this is the same concept exactly. When you start looking at somebody else's wife and thinking of how pleasant it would be for you to have her as your wife, or to have the relationship with her that goes with husband and wife, then you are already on your way toward that sin. And I doubt very seriously that any individual has ever committed adultery with some other person's wife who didn't first look at her with lust. And what Jesus is saying is you need to cut it off at the very point where it begins. When even such a thought occurs to you, that's when you've got to just remove that thought from your mind completely and not let yourself dwell on it. Of course, fornication is so closely related to this that we can go ahead and mention something else. In Mark's account of these words of Jesus, he not only mentions adultery and fornication, but he also mentions lasciviousness. I wonder how many of us could give a definition of lasciviousness. It's a word that just doesn't come up very often in modern speech, modern language, unless they're telling you about some wonderful movie that you just must see. You might see the word lascivious in that. But you probably would need a dictionary to tell you, except that the connotation is really pretty clear, I guess. And the fact is that people just don't commit adultery and fornication unless there's been some lasciviousness that has preceded it. Well, now, what is lasciviousness? There are several definitions that you might find, but I want to take you to a scholar who has been generally considered at least the most popular lexicographer to tell us the meaning of Greek words. Thayer says that lasciviousness is wanton acts, W-A-N-T-O-N, wanton acts, such as, and then he gives several things, and I'm going to mention them. I think I'll put it over here. Filthy words. Sometimes I need to watch out what I put on the board in these overhead. I guess somebody's telling me about one of the children here that had at the top of the sermon last Sunday morning, Sewell Hall's sermon, and then the next thing, point number one, there is no God. And point number two, failed to see that up the top, that was Satan's doctrine, of course. All right, but lasciviousness includes filthy words. We've gotten to the point where there are no words that are considered particularly filthy because people say just anything it seems that comes into their mind. But there are words that are filthy. There are words that stimulate and stir the wrong kind of thoughts. There are words that suggest this, just the removal of all restraint. And that's really the root of this idea of lasciviousness. It's unrestrained desire. And words, and you know, it's interesting that words can stir more and more as you repeat them. I have observed in my own self that if I get angry and I begin to express myself with anger, that the more I talk, the angrier I get. You ever notice that? Somebody said you let a lot of oxygen get in the... that just makes the fire burn brighter and brighter and brighter. Well, this is true here. The more you talk dirty, well, the more you think dirty, and the dirtiness just grows and increases as you use those words. What that saying is, you need to be very careful about what you say. And if you get around somebody who prefers to use this kind of language, you just better avoid them. Because words lead to deeds. It's filthy words that lead to fornication and adultery. So we need to be careful about the words we use. But this definition not only speaks of filthy words, but it also speaks about indecent bodily movements. There was a time when there were certain movements, bodily movements, that were not permitted in movies. I have a list of the rules that govern movies up to about 1950s or so. And there were certain movements that were not permitted on the screen. Now those movements are so common on television that nothing is even thought about it. And you see little children imitating those movements. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just so much of the dancing that is common in our time, obviously, involves indecent bodily movements. And if they're not indecent bodily movements, I would not know what indecent bodily movements are. Frankly, I wouldn't have any idea what could be done that would be any more indecent than what is done commonly in modern dancing. And I have a whole string of statements made by, well, people like Bob Hope and other worldly people when modern dancing, these modern dances first began, in which they use these very words. They're indecent, they said. They're obscene. But of course, over a period of years, they've come to be accepted, and now nobody observes that that's their nature. But he not only mentions unchaste bodily moves, he mentions something else. And I've known some young people who wouldn't dance for anything in the world. They've been taught that dancing is wrong. But the same scholar mentioned unchaste handling of males and females. And sometime, young people, I remember when I was in school, we had a young fella that wouldn't dance, and he'd preach against dancing. He was a preacher. He'd preach against dancing forevermore. But when he had a date, the girl said he just couldn't keep his hands off of them. Well, It's the same thing. If it stirs desires for what would be sinful, then it is lascivious and something that we need to avoid. And then the last definition is unbridled lust. Now, the point I'm making is, and I don't like to talk about these things. I think those of you who know me and know that this is not my favorite way to preach, but sometimes we just have to do it for the sake of clarity. When a person just doesn't normally get involved in fornication instantly. A person who's been absolutely pure and avoided lasciviousness doesn't just go out and commit fornication. There are some built-in restraints that prevent it. But lasciviousness tears down those restraints. The more you talk dirty, the more you think dirty. And as you begin to think dirty, the more likely you are to act that way. And indecent bodily movements Tear down those restraints. You'd be embarrassed to do some things that over a period of time you get willing to do. And then with chaste handling of males and females, too much physical proximity, then the barriers are just restrained until it comes to the point where it's just one more little step. And it's fornication. Now somebody says, well, but I just don't think it's sin unless you go all the way. It's lascivious. And lasciviousness is condemned right along with other things. It's letting our mind get into the position where and mentally we're practicing the sin anyway. And consequently, we're just a step away from that itself and the very unbridled lust. The failure to control ourselves is sin. Really, this is still that same thing we talked about as far as murder. It's the conclusion that my pleasure and my satisfaction and my happiness at this point are the most important things in the world. And what I have to do to a girl or what I have to do to a boy these days, well, that's just their tough luck. They're responsible. If it brings me pleasure, then that's what I have a right to do. My friends, the devil is on the ball. He is very, very shrewd. And he doesn't just come up with fornication. He leads you into it step by step by step. And our modern world is filled with the encouragement, the seducement to fornication and sin. And I plead with all of us, and it's not just young people, it's middle-aged people and some that are beyond middle age, who need to be warned against the kind of liberties that are being taken in association, in physical contact, and in language, the kinds of things that lead us towards the sin of fornication and adultery. And the consequences, not only of the fornication and adultery, but even the lasciviousness, are very, very serious in the lives of our lives. Well, and you say, well, I'm weak, I know. But I tell you what now, I'm never going to be guilty of theft. Well, there's some things that lead to theft. In Micah, the second chapter, in verse 2, Micah speaks about those who coveted fields and took them. Covetousness leads to theft. When you start looking at what somebody else has with an unreasonable desire, it's not wrong for me to say, I sure wish I had a car like somebody else has or a suit like somebody else has. That's not wrong. But when we start looking at it and thinking, why does he have it and I don't have it? I've got a right to it. I've got more right to it than he does. As that thought builds, that I have more right to it than he does, you're well on your way towards stealing it. But do you see that attitude again? My rights. What I have a right to have. And as we dwell on that, we're well on our way towards stealing it. But what about false witness? Well, I'd never stand up in court and lie to somebody. Well, will you tell little lies? Will you tell what? And I'll tell you now, I don't have any passage for white lies. But do you get the point where if you get in just a little bit of trouble, you can always just change the truth a little bit and get yourself out of trouble, turn off the heat? I'm sure every one of us has been tempted to do that. It's so easy just to kind of change it just a little, turn off the heat. And we can even justify ourselves sometimes, I'm just trying to defend my friend. I'm just trying to keep him out of trouble or her out of trouble, as the case may be. Once we begin twisting the truth, changing the truth just a little bit, for whatever purpose it may be, as we let that become a habit, we'll get to the point where even if it amounted to perjury, even if we were on the witness stand and were asked a question, if we thought it would be to our benefit or maybe to the benefit of our friend, we'd bear false witness. And somebody else might very well have to suffer. But once we've convinced ourselves that I have to look out for myself and my happiness and my well-being and my welfare are more important than anybody else, what's to keep us from lying if it's going to make us look better or going to keep somebody from getting in trouble that's my friend? And what about blasphemy? Well, I'd never blaspheme the name of God, but you know, I think we really need to be concerned about some of our euphemisms. Euphemisms, we used to preach against them. That is, getting just as close to the name of God as possible. Bless your heart, people don't use euphemisms most anymore. A euphemism is a substitute for something that you'd not be willing to say, but you say what substitutes for it and doesn't sound quite so bad. People just go and say it now. People just go and use the name of God these days and don't really seem to think anything about it. Once more, in the Sermon on the Mount, if Jesus wasn't warning against this kind of thing, I hardly know what he was warning against. When he says in verse 34 of Matthew 5, I say to you, do not swear at all. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes and your no, no. And whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Now, I think primarily probably there, he's talking about being absolutely truthful under all circumstances. But he makes it clear that when you just get as close to God's name or God himself as you possibly can by saying by heaven or by earth or by my head even, you're approaching God. And if we get accustomed to using these kinds of things as expletives, the next thing we know, when things really get tough, we'll use the name of God. Sometimes we use language like that and don't even realize the connections. I know that very well. And I have done that. My wife's been a help to me sometime, even in preaching. I've said some things, and she said, do you realize how close you got to some other word? I hadn't realized it. I just picked it up from somebody. And you know, most of our problems along that line, if we're pure-minded Christian people, are that we just repeat something we hear somebody else say, but it came originally from the devil in most instances. And to whatever degree we can, it's good for us just to purge our speech of all kinds of such things and speak very precisely. Let our yes be yes and our no, no. And realize that whatever is more than these comes from the evil one. The point I'm making this morning is this, and I hope it's very clear, that the devil is extremely active. He is working to get into the life of every one of us. And he has some place, I suspect, that he has carved out some little niche in the life of every one of us. But as those who truly love God, and I'm sure that's true of this congregation that I'm speaking to this morning, I believe that those who are older, those who are middle-aged, I believe our young people really want to do what's right. But Satan is so clever, and he is so slippery, and he's coming up on us from the blind side and getting us involved in things that don't appear to be too serious. And he'll get us involved in things that everybody else considers perfectly acceptable, perfectly all right. But it's like the bait that we give to the fish. There's a hook in it. The fish sees the minnow, and the minnow just looks really good. That minnow just is really what he wants, and he can't see any harm in the minnow. Well, there's not any harm in the minnow. The problem is in the hook that's in the minnow. And in many of the things that the devil is holding out before us, we don't see the harm in it, but he's got a hook in it. And just as surely as we bite, then that hook catches us and he reels us in before we really realize what has happened to us. We could go on and talk about drunkenness. We say, well, I don't want to ever get drunk. Well, you get drunk when you start just playing with drinking, just a little bit at a time. And you can get drunk on things other than alcohol, by the way. In fact, this condition of drunkenness and absence of sobriety and the lack of control over your thoughts and your body and your actions, that can develop other drugs as well as alcohol. And Satan would sometimes take young people, I think, who would not touch alcohol because they've been taught they shouldn't do that. But we get to experimenting with little things that other people are using, and it don't seem to be doing any harm. And the first thing we know, this feeling that I think I have a right to have, and it's my body, and I enjoy it, and I like it, and it's good for me. The first thing we know, we've let it begin to get hold of us, and we need some more, and we need some more, whether it's alcohol or crack or marijuana or whatever it is. We need more and more and more, and we'll sacrifice our grades at school. We'll sacrifice our efficiency on the job. And the first thing we know, we're sacrificing the happiness of our family and sacrificing our health and everything else as Satan just reels us in little by little by little. And the mistake was ever biting in the first place. It's because of love that we plead with you to be aware of Satan's devices. Be aware of the fact that he's trying to catch you. He's trying to destroy you. And realize that it is the devil behind it. Now, it may be your best friend. It may be a really good boy otherwise, a really good girl otherwise, or a really good adult that is encouraging you in something that, well, you know it's tainted. You know that it has led a lot of people into sin. Well, even though it may be a good person, Satan is working through that person. And don't let Satan take advantage of you. Don't let Satan destroy your faith. Make up your mind that I'm being tested, I'm being tempted. The question is, am I going to go with Satan even a little way? Or am I going to cling to the Lord? We've sung some beautiful songs this morning. Be with me, Lord. I cannot live without thee. I cannot take one step without thine aid. If we want the Lord to be with us, we're going to have to go with him all the way. And only engage in those things that we know he can engage in with us. Only say those kinds of things that we know he can be with us as we say. And the Lord would not be embarrassed by what we say and do. This is the kind of relationship we must have with the Lord in order to resist Satan and his temptation. Peter began to sink, you remember, when he took his eyes off the Lord. Moses made his grave mistake when the Lord said, you didn't believe me. You lost sight of me temporarily. You thought only of yourself. These are the kinds of things that Satan uses to lead us astray. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, let me plead with you to come to the Lord. The Lord can help you through these temptations and provide you with the forgiveness of the guilt that is already on your soul. He loves you. He died to save you. And he wants to reach out to you and receive you and give you the strength and the comfort and the help that he can give you. Won't you accept him? Won't you put your faith in him? The devil will try every way in the world to tempt you, to not to express your faith. We suggested the other morning that Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. And just as soon as you begin to believe sufficiently to be baptized, the devil will try to stop it right then and there. And he'll tell you, you don't need to be baptized. That's unnecessary. If you're going to be saved by grace, he doesn't want you to do what the Lord tells you to do. Have enough faith in Jesus, not only to say I believe, but to go on to do what the Lord wants you to do, not only in baptism, but in living the rest of your life for him. It'll be the best decision you have ever made. You'll never regret it if you're faithful and true to it. And our prayer is that somebody here this morning will express faith in baptism or in some other way if there's something you need to do to express your faith in the Lord. We stand and sing to encourage you.